This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
Billy Frank changed from being the guy who got arrested on the riverbank to being the diplomat representing Pacific Salmon in the boardrooms of corporations and agencies in the United States and around the world, really.
There's no denying that the current moment is grim for the environment, civil rights, and plain old human decency. But I once heard a wise man say that cynicism is the real enemy of progress. So now more than ever, we must find ways to keep ourselves from falling into a cynical frame of mind. One way to do that is to reflect on the accomplishments of the brave people who've come before us to fight for justice and topple seemingly unstoppable Goliaths. This week on Sea Change Radio, my guest is Larry Nielsen, a professor of natural resources at North Carolina State and the author of a new book called Nature's Allies. The book profiles some of the heroes that shaped the modern environmental movement, from famous figures like John Muir and Rachel Carson to lesser-known activists like Ding Darling and Billy Frank Jr. Then we dip into the Sea Change Radio archives to hear from an MIT grad turned knife maker extraordinaire. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Larry Nielsen. His new book is Nature's Allies. Larry, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Well, thank you very much, Alex. It's a pleasure to be with you.
I wanted to have you on because with so much dark news in the environmental space these days and the political realm, I thought it was important to go back to some of the roots, some of the people who've made the environmental movement what it is today. Why don't you first tell us the inspiration behind Nature's Allies and give us a brief executive summary of the book, if you will.
Yes, I'm happy to do that. Throughout my career, I have always thought that it's important for us in the conservation area, because it's a young field, only about a century old, really, as a profession, for us to be able to know about the so-called shoulders of the giants we stand on. And so it's always been an interest of me to write about and talk about these people that have gone before. And now today, I think I didn't intend for it to be as timely as it is, but it is timely with the news that's going on, the feeling today that maybe our environment is going to be under some threat in the coming few years. And therefore, I think it's important for people to understand that today, they have the opportunity as individuals to continue to make a difference, a positive difference in our world, just like those that came before have done as part of the earlier conservation movements.
And you profile eight conservationists, including John Muir and Rachel Carson, Wangari Maathai, who's been a guest on Sea Change Radio before her recent passing a few years ago. Huh. So why don't you tell us first a little bit about some interesting things that people might not know about John Muir, for example.
Well, John Muir is an interesting case, and I start the book with him because most people considered him to be the father of American conservation and one of the greatest conservationists of all times. He was so interesting because we think of him as sort of a hermit, someone who didn't like people, who would rather be away from people. But like all of us, he's a complex individual. He was a great family man, the life of the party. He loved a party, loved to be around people and tell stories. And that storytelling opportunity and part of his character, I think, is what led him initially to become popular as he began to write some stories about his experiences in the West. But I opened the book with one of the great ones that people just can't believe, which is he loved to be out in nature and get as authentic a feeling as he could. And so one time a big windstorm and rainstorm was coming down the Sierras, and he decided, while other people were heading inside, he said, you know, this is a great opportunity for me to understand what it's like to be a tree in a storm. So he found the tallest tree he could find, climbed up to the very top, lashed himself there for several hours to experience what it was like flying around at the top of a tree in the middle of a terrible storm. That's the kind of guy John Muir was.
Definitely a risk taker.
Oh, yes.
But he was pretty well known in his time, right? He didn't live in obscurity in his efforts, correct?
No, he did not. He became a very popular magazine writer. It was at a time when people were very interested in the romance of the American West, and he began to write stories about California and Yosemite and that area, and they attracted a lot of attention of Eastern readers, especially the sort of the higher level readers that would read magazines today like The Atlantic or The New Yorker. And the stories of the American West were just amazing to them, and his adventures, and like you say, he was a risk taker, and he would climb to the edge of a waterfall and look over the edge to see what was happening there. He would climb on glaciers and sometimes fall into crevasses. People love that experience, and they became very well known and wealthy, of course, from his work, and that fame is what allowed him, along with Robert Underwood Johnson, publisher from the East, to lobby effectively. John Muir wrote and Johnson lobbied in Washington for the passage of Yosemite National Park, and it came to be.
And now let's contrast that with Rachel Carson, who wrote a very famous book, Silent Spring, a bestseller which many people credit as the inspiration for the modern environmentalist movement. But she was almost a J.D. Salinger-like character in that she was most reclusive. Tell us the story of how Rachel Carson ended up becoming such an inspirational character despite not really putting herself forward as the face of the generation or the face of the movement.
Well, you're quite right, Alex. She was very shy. We would call her a wallflower today. She didn't like attention, and she was a very private person. And there were things that had gone on in her family life that she wasn't proud of, she wasn't happy about, and she really didn't want anybody to know about it. Remember, this is the 1950s, not today, when, you know, we don't care what happened, everything's all right. So then she was very, very protective of her privacy and her parent and her family's privacy. And she really did not want in any way to become the center of attention when she wrote Silent Spring. And she often would write to friends about how amused she was that people were interested in her rather than just in her books. But she became convinced that the broadcast spraying of pesticides was a bad thing. Not pesticides necessarily themselves being a bad thing when applied correctly and by knowledgeable people, but the broadcast spraying of them over huge areas in order to kill a particular bug or a particular problem concerned her greatly. And so despite the fact that she did not want to start a revolution, did not want to be in the center of things, she researched and wrote the book, a book that caused great interest and also a great negative backlash from chemical industry, the agricultural industry, and the U.S. government. And she, getting to the media, she didn't take interviews. She didn't like television at all, but finally was convinced that she should appear on the TV show CBS Reports, which is kind of like a 60-minute type show 50 years ago. And she was quite worried about what would happen, that she wouldn't appear to be knowledgeable or convincing. And quite the reverse occurred. when she was on this interview show, interviewed by Eric Severide, she won the day. She was calm. She was professional. She was informed. She gave a logical, unemotional report of what she had learned. In contrast to the people on the other side who, there was a spokesperson for the agricultural chemical industry who appeared, in my opinion, I've watched it many times, pretty much like a Boris Karloff mad scientist kind of person, and a representative from the U.S. government who basically said, you know, we don't know anything about this stuff. And that interview on that show is what really carried the day and made the American people and the leadership of the United States take seriously these threats from these broadcast pesticides.
And we can almost directly draw a link between Carson's work and having creatures like bald eagles in relative abundance again today, can't we?
Yes, absolutely. The change in the way we began to use pesticides and disperse pesticides counteracted or stopped the continuing problems with eggshell thinning and other sorts of problems with the bioaccumulation of pesticides. And I think the fact that the bald eagle today is not even on the endangered species list anymore. Fish and Wildlife Service does not specifically track its abundance year to year like they did for a long time, because the bald eagle has recovered tremendously. And so have many other predatory birds that sit at the top of the food chain and were the ones that were most likely to be impacted by the biomagnification of these environmental poisons that start at the bottom of the food chain and work their way up to them.
I will be king, and you will be my queen. Though nothing will drive them away, we can beat them just for one day. For one day, and you can be me.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Larry Nielsen. He's a professor of natural resources at North Carolina State University, and his new book is Nature's Allies, 8 Conservationists Who Changed Our World. So we've discussed John Muir and Rachel Carson, Larry, people who a lot of Sea Change listeners are already familiar with, but I bet most people don't know who, let's say, Billy Frank Jr. is. Why don't you tell us the tale of Billy Frank Jr.? He sounds like quite a character and an important person in the environmental movement, of course.
Right. Well, I think Billy Frank Jr., to me, among the 8 people I profile in the book, Billy Frank Jr. is the inspiration, the biggest inspiration that I get from and got from working on these people. Billy Frank Jr. was a Nisqually Indian. The Nisqually Nation lives just southeast of Tacoma, Washington, on the Nisqually River. Now, a treaty signed with the U.S. government in 1854 established that those Indians and ones in the groups around them could fish forever in all their traditional locations using whatever methods they wished. Now, that didn't matter for a long time, but as the world started getting more crowded and more aggressive about its interaction with the native world after World War II, the condition of Pacific salmon stocks in the Pacific Northwest went down very rapidly. And people started looking for somebody to blame, and they blamed the Native American fishermen who were taking fish in ways and in places that were not permitted by the state of Washington, etc. Well, Billy Frank continued to fish that way despite he and his colleagues getting increasingly harassed and hassled by the game officials in Washington. And in fact, Billy Frank Jr. was arrested more than 50 times for just doing what he and others believed was their right guaranteed by their treaty. Now, eventually, Billy Frank's actions, with the help of some others, including a great Native American communications strategist, Hank Adams, it became part of the 1960s social movement for, anti-war, pro-feminism, civil rights, and all of that. The condition of Native Americans became part of the issue. And eventually, a federal attorney sued the state of Washington for failing to recognize these treaty rights. And in a landmark decision, and this is a very timely thing that we're talking about because the landmark decision was made on February 12th, 1974, 43 years ago, right about this time of year. The landmark decision made by Judge Hugo Bolt said the Indians were correct, that they and allocated 50% of the Pacific salmon catch to the Indians. But even more important than that, it said that the Indians had co-management authority with the state of Washington and the federal agencies that were involved. Now, that ushered in a whole new era of fisheries management in the United States and really worldwide, because now we had to know how many fish there were, how many fish could be caught, what the long-term population dynamics were, and all of that scientific work associated with now the Pacific salmon being the most studied fish stocks in the world and some of the best managed, all owes itself to the fact that Billy Frank Jr. continued to fish, continued to exert his treaty guaranteed rights, and the federal government eventually said, yeah, Billy, you're right. And a tremendous story, really, and one that few people know, even if they know about the Bolt decision. And one of the great things about Billy Frank Jr., he never got angry or disgusted or violent. He loved people, and he made friends wherever he went. And as this law was established and reinforced by the Supreme Court, and then had to be implemented, Billy Frank changed from being the guy who got arrested on the riverbank to being the diplomat representing Pacific salmon in the boardrooms of corporations and agencies in the United States and around the world, really.
Well, what really caught my eye about Billy Frank Jr. was not just, you said, the guy who got arrested trying to defend fishing rights. He didn't just get arrested. He got arrested more than 50 times. That takes some serious perseverance.
It does indeed. And, you know, he tells the story, told the story that it got to be such a routine thing so that people didn't even pay a lot of attention. In fact, he said, well, you know, if I didn't come home for supper, people knew that I was probably arrested, and they'd take some piece of property, go down, pawn it, and then take the money to bail him out of jail, and then he'd come home and eat dinner.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Larry Nielsen. His book is called Nature's Allies, 8 Conservationists Who Changed Our World. So I want to touch upon one more interesting character before I let you go, Larry. Ding Darling, somebody I did not know, known as... His nickname was Ding. He's J. Norwood Darling. He was a cartoonist originally, a newspaper man, who really made an important contribution to setting up the more formal conservation movement under FDR. Why don't you explain the journey that Ding Darling experience from the turn of the century, 1900, till when his impact was felt most in the 30s.
Sure. Ding Darling is a terrific character as well. As you say, he was an editorial cartoonist. He grew up in the westernmost corner of Iowa, the child of the prairie and the frontier. And he loved nature and loved conservation right from being a boy all the way through his life. But he found his career as being a cartoonist for the newspapers, the Des Moines Register, for most of his life. And he drew editorial cartoons for half a century, won the Pulitzer Prize for cartooning twice during his life. He was also a devout conservationist and often drew conservation-related cartoons when he wanted to get that message across. And remember, at that time, editorial cartoons were not buried in the middle of the newspaper. They were on the front page, above the fold. That was the first thing you looked at. So he was using his position as an editorial cartoonist, and he was syndicated around the country. But he really didn't like Franklin Roosevelt at all. He was a great admirer of Herbert Hoover, which most people weren't, and he thought that Roosevelt was evil. He thought his policies were wrong. He thought the New Deal was going to bankrupt the United States. He really didn't care for him at all, and he didn't care for his conservation policies either, and was a constant critic of Roosevelt. Until one day, the phone rang, and Ding Darling picked up the phone and said hello, and on the other end, it was President Roosevelt, who said, I'm not quoting here, but who said, you've been complaining for a long time now. Get in here and run the agency and see what you can do. And Darling thought to Darling that he would actually do this work on behalf of Roosevelt was, you know, it was a horrible thought to him. But he then thought to himself, this is my chance to do something important for conservation. And he went into Washington working for Roosevelt and ran what was then called the Biological Survey. Today it's the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And really became, as he's well known as, the best friend a duck ever had, because he took the National Wildlife Refuge System, which there were a few refuges at that time, but they were pretty much ignored. And he said, we're going to make it work. And he developed the National Wildlife Refuge into the wonderful resource that we have today, more than 560 refuges around the country. But they were started really and began as a way to help migratory waterfowl, ducks and geese, and the major flyways. And he was a tremendous advocate for that. And he only lasted 20 months in the federal bureaucracy. He couldn't take it, and he and Roosevelt got more and more on each other's nerves, and he went back to his job. But in those 20 months, he had an enormous influence, turning the now Fish and Wildlife Service from a sleepy, lazy, perhaps even corrupt agency into one that is the primary agency for wildlife conservation in the United States and a premier example of what we can do around the world. He was the person who got the duck stamp going, and you know, many, many people today buy duck stamps. It's like a federal license for migratory waterfowl. And he got that moving and going, the first ones issued, and over the life of that so far, it's raised nearly $1 billion for buying wildlife refuges, maintaining them and improving them. Such an efficient program. 98% of all the money, 98 cents of every dollar, goes directly into doing the work of the agency. It's tremendous.
And today he has a national wildlife refuge named after him in Florida.
Right, on Sanibel Island. And interestingly, I'll be down there next year about this time talking about Ding Darling's contribution at the refuge.
Well, this is a terrific recap of some of the better known and more intriguing names in the environmental annals, and it's important work, and I strongly urge our listeners to go out and check it out. It's called Nature's Allies, The author is Larry Nielsen. Larry, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Well, that was great, Alex. Thank you very much for having me.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/seachangeradio and on our Facebook page.
Next, we dig into the Sea Change Radio archives and listen to my October 2015 interview with knife maker extraordinaire Adam Simha. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by my friend Adam Simha. He is the founder of MKS Knife, and folks can go to mksdesign.com to check out his work. Adam, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks so much. It's a pleasure.
Well, you do some amazing stuff with knives. First, why don't you explain your journey to becoming a knife maker?
Well, thank you. I had been making metal furniture for a number of years, first out of necessity and then out of compulsion. And I took a bladesmithing class. This is the late 90s now, and found myself once again hooked. Fire and electricity and respect and understanding for materials and process that was new to me, and an amazing journey, one that one never steps off.
So Adam, Sea Change Radio is mostly about environmental issues and sustainability. Why is knife making a sustainability issue in your mind?
Well, on several levels, I would say, in my case, since most of the majority of what I do is culinary, making things for people that they will be paying a lot more for than they might otherwise had they gone to a store, but will consequently value more and care for more and use more. So that means that they will be cooking more at home, thinking more about what they're eating and what they're buying, and all of that going towards consuming less and taking more time and more care about the things that they are consuming. And also that knife that they have invested in, they're going to invest in taking care of. If you think about every time you take your knife to get sharpened, more than likely there's an amount of material being taken off of that knife that is as much as would wear off in years of use. So if you take care of it yourself at home, you're going to reduce that by the factor of 50, I mean, literally, that when you bring it to get it sharpened, it doesn't need much. Means that knife could very easily last you the rest of your life.
It would seem that somebody who invests a little bit more in their knife or their knife collection would be more inclined to eat at home, which is in an age where we're throwing away more and more food, particularly in restaurants, that's a good thing.
Absolutely. And the data that I have is anecdotal, but it is from practically every person that I have made a custom knife for, that they don't feel the need to have a motley collection. They have one, maybe two, and they're invested in taking care of it and really love to have it around and love to use it. And so they make a point of using it more, and they think about what they're going to be cooking and the fact that spending more money on less, say, meat or quality fish is well worth it in the grand scheme of things. And it's also more of a pleasure to cook and eat. The translation from quality tool to eating more healthily and more responsibly is pretty stark. And I found that people have come back and told me that it's been a life-changing experience.
Folks can go see Adam's beautiful work at mksdesign.com. Adam Simha, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by Grant Green and David Bowie.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. and tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.